and we got Elizabeth Humphreys on the line, political economist at the University of Technology in Sydney. How are you this morning?
Yeah, not too bad. Morning, how are you?
Yeah, good. Thanks for joining us.
Well, we decided that we were going to hunt you down because it's a perfect time to talk to you about how Labor built neoliberalism. And I know that, of course, this is your first book, not your latest book, but the concept that you brought forward to people was such a shock to many people, especially the people in the Labor Party camp, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think, obviously, I titled the book a little bit of a provocation. We always sort of think about neoliberalism as being built by the new right or by the Liberal Party, and certainly that's what many in the Labor Party argued. But I think we've got to confront reality a little bit, that in Australia, as compared to, say, in Britain under Maggie Thatcher or the US under Ronald Reagan, that really neoliberalism rolled out here under the Labor Party when it was, you know, involved in the accord with the trade union movement.
There's a really lot of evidence that, in actual fact, Bob Hawke was big pals with CIA and other parts of the American establishment, and that he was part of the rearrangement of the furniture in the Australian political scene.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, for those who are a bit younger, you know, Bob Hawke was president of the ACTU before he became prime minister. But he was elected on a massive wave of public support in a real landslide in 1983. And it did, after the Fraser years, really arrange, I guess, how politics was done in this country. After a long time sort of in the wilderness, the unions and the labour movement had a seat at the table on economic planning and economic matters. And that government, of course, was a 13-year Commonwealth Australian government, sort of known internationally now as one of the most successful labourist governments.
Yeah, it was. I lived through that period as a worker, watching one of the most fascinating elements of, say, Paul Keating's arrangement was that in the workplace that I was in, some of the things that he established worked all the way down into, filtered all the way down to the level of meetings at RMIT. And I just thought, this is such a interesting idea that you've got people who know how the machine works, because that's what the Labor Party was able to do, wasn't it? It knew how the machine worked, unlike the Liberals.
Yeah, in the 1970s, there was a massive economic crisis. There were 10 recessions in 10 years, five recessions in 10 years before the Labor Party came to power in 1983. And it was a period of enormous economic stress, with inflation going up and wages not keeping pace with that. At the same time, the unions were at their strongest historically. Density, meaning the number of people in the workforce who were union members, was over 50%. For me, I grew up in Werribee in the outer suburbs of Melbourne, as people would know, and my dad worked in the oil refinery at Altona. So I remember living through, as a child, that enormous pressure and stress of those recessions. And, of course, that economic turmoil continued into the 80s. The reason the Labor Party came to power is because that kind of, tension between the Fraser Liberal government wanting to hold down wages and curtail union power, and the unions being so powerful that the Fraser government couldn't do that, it really didn't get resolved. It only gets, I think, a different path forward when the Labor Party comes to power under Hawke, and then later Keating is leader, but with a different economic plan or vision, and that was called the Prices and Incomes Accord, which was how I think that kind of economic stalemate got resolved in a way.
Yeah, the ability to, like, on the outside, Hawke was the flim-flam man. He was able to come up with a whole range of incredible promotional activities that brought people together, while on the other hand, Keating was able to use a certain structural procedures that changed the power dynamics of the economy.
I think it's always hard to tell where Hawke began and where Keating ended in that period. And for me, I often sort of want to step back and say, well, what was the bigger thing that they tried to put in place? And when we look at the accord, it starts off as a bit of a agreement that's not just going to hold down wages, but it's going to offer working people a bunch of things
social,
like Medicare and superannuation. Yeah, and but what does that promise and the reason that the unions backed that in the end, is that really what happens? And that's not really the case.
No, it didn't.
It really narrows quite quickly, as you would remember, to suppressing wages in that period. And yeah, Hawke might be the front person who sells it, and Keating might be the brain behind it. But really, this is a collective project of the labour movement in that period to address the economic crisis. And we get to look back now and see how well it suppressed wages and held down working class struggle. But at the time, I think for a lot of reasons, a lot in the labour movement backed it in the hope that it would actually bring something bigger, better. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've been reading as a companion piece almost Liz Ross's history of the deregistration of the BLF, and it's funny how these two, like your two books, kind of present like a micro and macro play on like what's going on in the situation. But really, like even the Accord was pretty amazing in the way that it ruptured the trade union movement, and how after that it really hasn't. It's only worsened the situation, like leading up to what's happening with the CFMEU now under another Labor government.
The word I use is the disorganisation of the working class. I think that I sort of imagine it like this. Whitlam comes to power and the Labor movement and many others believe there's going to be this period of change and positive reform. Some of that rolls out, but the Whitlam government is obviously dismissed in this massive upheaval. And all of a sudden, the Labor movement is back on the outside of politics, of formal politics, but they're really strong. And so in the Fraser period, they're kind of ejected from the formal political scene. But what happens with Hawke coming to power is the unions are brought back into the centre, back in to the table, and they get involved in this accord over that 13 years. And, you know, Liz Ross also has a book on the accord which is wonderful as well. And I think that period, that 13 years dramatically changes both what the unions do, what they look like, and how the working class, I guess, is organised. So, you know, I said before that at the start of the Accord, 50% of workers were members of unions. Well, we know this is as low as like 13, 15% now, and much lower in the private sector. The level of organisation of working class people through trade unions to defend their rights is at an all-time low in this country. And so the studies of the BLF have been partly because of the high successes of the green bands, but also because, and Liz Ross mentions this in her book, because they were one of the few unions that actually were critical of the accord, and that leads in part to their deregistration. You know, I know they say the deregistration is about corruption, but it's also because it's a militant union with that sort of history. And, you know, you can already sort of hear an echo of parallels today with the CFMEU. You know, the CFMEU, it's not got the sort of density that the BLF did. There are lots of construction workers working in sites around this country where there's no unionisation. But on some sites, particularly in big cities, they still can exert serious power, and they do, right? They break the law to go on strike when it's illegal to demand workers' rights. And that is always confronting, I think, for Labor parties when they're in power.
Well, you know, it's interesting about the CFMEU, and brings us back to the connection between Labor and the working class, is that there was a lot of discussion on the Concrete Gang, which is a program at 3CR, about a lot of cutting of corners in government jobs, that government infrastructure jobs could not be relied on to behave in a proper manner, a safe manner, or that people's wages were being paid correctly, even though they'd been given these contracts by the government. Now, of course, the government's a Labor government, and it's in a tenuous situation because of an election coming up. Now, for the working class, being safe at work and being paid are bread and butter issues, which seem to be in contrast to what the political ambitions of the Labor Party.
Yeah, unions obviously get formed out of those basics, right? When unions are set up in this country, it's about the basics of wages and conditions pre-federation. And, of course, occupational health and safety is an absolute bread and butter. And sometimes in the reporting about the CFMEU, that is lost, that construction is still one of the more dangerous industries to be involved in. As is truck driving, right, and working in agriculture. But it's and, you know, one of my research projects with Sarah Gregson from the University of New South Wales is on the Westgate Bridge disaster in 1970. Now, we can have our attention drawn sometimes by these big disasters when a significant number of workers are killed or injured. It was 35 workers were killed in that industrial accident. But actually, it's the workers who die in ones and twos
That's
in
right.
construction every single year that is the thing that drives still today that tally. And the media can sometimes sort of present it as if the construction union or other unions, maritime union, are using safety as a sort of excuse to make trouble, when actually the reality is this is dangerous work, and it's done outside in extremely hot weather and rain, and, you know, occupational health and safety is serious business. The neoliberal era has sort of wanted to build the idea that everyone is responsible for workplace health and safety. Now, this, on one level, is true. Everybody is responsible, the individual worker and the boss. But there's only one of those parties that can ensure the equipment is paid for, that it's top-notch, that people stop working when the weather is dangerous, and that's the employer. Ultimately, employers have to ensure the safety of workers, and this shift in the idea of responsibility onto individuals and individual workers is something that's got to be resisted, and is resisted by the CFMEU.
Because we're coming to the end of our conversation, let's bring it back to the major contention of your original thesis, how Labor built neoliberalism. I saw you at a meeting a long time ago where you were talking about this, and there were a whole range of, at the Trades Hall here in Melbourne, and there were people in the audience who were obviously part of the negotiations for into the accord, and they were very aggrieved at you making these statements. Why do you think it's so difficult for people in the Labor movement to actually stare down history in this, take it on and agree, realise that we were sold a pup?
Yeah, I'm glad you noticed that, because it's not the only time that that's happened. I definitely have spoken in public on about the book and at many sorts of events in Sydney and Melbourne, and had that happen. I do think that some who were involved in unions in that period structuring the accord want to defend that period. I'm often at pains to explain that I grew up in a working class family, and my dad, you know, worked in an oil refinery, partly because those sorts of people want to suggest that because I'm an academic, I don't really understand the realities of what that lived reality was. But I can tell you the reason I studied this topic is because I wanted an explanation of what happened in the 80s and 90s. But, you know, I can remember to go when I went to uni, living off piddly income and relying on food parcels every week because I couldn't get by. Yeah. And it, sometimes those people are so invested in defending that period of the past that they can't do that step back to say, what the hell happened? And it wasn't that people weren't critical at the time. Liz Ross is a bit older than me. I'm 51. Oh God, she's, you know, she's got 10 or 15 years easily on me. But you talk to her, people criticised the accord as it was coming out. And whilst they weren't the majority and they weren't strong enough to defeat it at the time, there were concerns and contention. But the biggest and most powerful union in the period in that, the metals workers, which now became sort of part of the ANWU, they were key backers of that accord. And so I find sometimes I come across researchers from the Metal Workers Union at that time, and they absolutely want to defend that. But I think as people who build unions today, and that I might be an academic, but I'm also a unionist and a union member, we have to understand what did getting involved in that agreement with a government do for the level of organisation and power within trade unions. And it's only then that means we can proceed with today. Because there's calls all the time for a new accord, right, for a new agreement for government. But really for me, what the issue that confronts us as trade unionists is how do we rebuild some of that independent strength of trade unions to fight both for the basics of workplace health and safety and conditions. And this is more urgent than ever. In an era of climate change where heat really is the thing that will kill us first, it's absolutely essential that unions begin to reorganise serious power to ensure keep workers' safety, be able to keep workers safe in an era where temperatures are going up.
That's your other research that you do, yeah, to the Too Hot to Work campaign stuff. And how do you see that with, like, I mean, the legacy that it's similar how it plays out in the Accord, where a Labor Party introduces something and then the Liberal Party inherits that framework and makes it immediately worse with what's happening in Queensland with all the victories that the CFMU won on being too hot to work being rolled back now?
Yeah, I think that's always a danger, is that we have to defend what has been won. Like, we can think, just look at what's happening with LGBTIQ rights in Australia and in the US. We always have to defend what has been won. And that's why this independent union strength that's not tied to the Labor Party being in power is hugely important. Because governments can and will change. Labor parties can and will disappoint. And in the end, it's only if we rebuild the kind of union strength that we saw in the 70s and early 80s that we can achieve that. And we've got to keep in mind that unions want incredible things. The metal workers, before they kind of jumped into this accord, you know, they were the ones leading the fight for having a shorter working week for the same money to try and deal with unemployment. There's an enormous proud history in the unions who were central in the end to the rollout of the accord. And I think we criticise the things that we did wrong in the past. We celebrate the enormous victories and where we held our ground, even if it wasn't successful. And we think what is required now in an era of climate change, in attacks on workers' rights over work health and safety, but also on those social issues that that I've just mentioned. You know, Sam Wolman is working on his book on the pink bands about how the BLF defended the rights of gay and lesbian students at Macquarie Uni, of all places, in Sydney, right? We've got to draw on the inspiration of that history and the world-leading history of the BLF in doing that of construction workers to then say, yeah, on the front foot now to defend basic conditions and the social rights of the working class.
Well, it's interesting you should bring that up because, of course, the green bands were so successful because the union and social groups worked together, you know, like there were so people were realising their particular power relationship to the power elites. And actually what happened with the accord, it seems to me, is that when Laurie Carmichael decided that it would be worth the social contract, he was showing good faith. But of course, the big end of town doesn't care about good faith. People have to remember where real power lies and not to to hold the line effectively.
Yeah, look, I agree with that. I think sometimes the radical left can look at the accord people and just want to say bad people did bad things, right? Even on the labour movement side. But there's no doubt in my mind that Laurie Carmichael entered that accord process thinking it was going to improve the lives of union members and working people generally. So we can be honest about what happened and we can be honest about how Laurie as an individual, but also many in unions, got drawn into a process that in the end was against their own interests. But that doesn't mean that they were those bad people doing bad things. But for me, it's more about, yes, being drawn into this process that in the end becomes fit for purpose and fit for neoliberalism. So we can be honest about that and not want to defend going into the accord. But we could also, like I think, reflect on the fact that Laurie did actually want, a different situation and much more economic and social justice for working people in this country. And for me, like, it's about seeing how the hope that led those big unions and those leaders, John Halfpenny's another one, right? Another Victorian who backed and was central to the accord. Things might not have worked out. Let's not do it again, but we need to have the sort of discussions that plan what can working people and trade unions do to exercise power in relation to economic decision-making in this country, both under the Albanese government but under the next one as well.
Thanks very much for talking to us this morning.
Absolute pleasure.